Haunters. I'm your host, Ed Gannon, professional haunter, Something Wicked Productions, Wicked Amusements, and Haunted Dogs. And in this episode of Something Wicked, we'll talk about how professional haunted attractions were established, grew, and created the industry we know today. This will be a fun segment to any Halloween slash haunted house fan, so listen up, kiddies.
Satan, if these folks want to hear another of our pretty little bedtime stories, you just tell them to douse out them lights so we'll have it nice and dark. Now draw up to the fire and gaze into the embers. Gaze into them deep, and soon you'll be down.
How did haunted houses get started? Scary attractions were not always a thing, and certainly nothing like we have today. Many of you may know the beginnings were all due to some entrepreneurs looking to make a buck by giving guests the thrill of a lifetime. While there was the original dark ride in London in the 1890s, the fad didn't really catch on until a little later. These pleasure trains, they were called, are old mill rides, either used a track or a small boat to pull people through darkness and scary vignettes. They were often called the Tunnel of Love because they were supposed to make your lady cling onto you for safety from the scary scenes. It was 1903 at Luna Park and later Dreamland Park as well, both in Coney Island, New York. These amazing, thrilling recreational beaches, boardwalks, and amusements were the destination for fun in that part of the country. People wanted thrills with a little danger, a lot of excitement, and something to tell their friends about after. There were very few laws and regulations in regards to what an attraction or ride could do. Thrill seekers were always looking for the next most daring adventure experience they could find on Coney Island, so promoters and designers delivered. Many of the rides and attractions featured a physical element that moved or shifted you around somehow. It didn't take long to figure out people liked getting scared, not just thrilled. Some of the very first dark rides, like A Trip to the Moon after the Jules Verne-inspired silent film, were installed at Luna Park in 1903. Soon after, other dark rides and walk-through spook houses arrived in the parks and on the pier, one of which was featured in a Little Rascals short.
Many enter this evil house, but few depart alive.
Back then, the thrill was most important, so elements like treadmills, other moving floors, physical obstacles, and even drops or chutes would put the guests through the ringer. People left these early spook houses knowing they had been through an experience. Injuries were common and partly expected in exchange for the excitement. What are now unsafe building materials, flammable components, homemade mechanisms, all mostly unregulated, back then were just what everyone used. And add to that, the brand new electricity and lights all resulted in several fires that completely wiped out entire theme parks, some like Dreamland, never to return. Fires would become the eradicator of most of these attractions on the piers all the way up to the 1980s. But the early 1900s were the heyday of these attractions. Almost none of them could be built today, and as unsafe as some may have been, the experience guests received then surpassed most of anything they could get in the 21st century. Certainly, wonders exist today, and technology is way more sophisticated, which would have seemed like magic 100 years ago, but the thrill was real and intense. Producers realized folks liked being scared for entertainment. The main outlet for people were scary movies in the theaters, the only place you could see a movie. Monster movies were big money. Then World War I happened. People had real horrors to deal with. Then World War II happened, and again, lots of real horror around. But people always want to escape and challenge themselves. How much horror could I take? Would I do what the people in the movies do? Or would I choose better? Then come the 1950s. Here we start to see the beginnings of haunted shows, the Midnight Spookers. A producer would get a hold of a horror film or three, sometimes a print of Frankenstein or Dracula, but usually some B-movie they got on the cheap and perhaps never had a wide release. Then they would go to a theater owner and rent it for overnight or late night shows, usually a weekend or two, and these shows would start at midnight after the regular movies were over. This way, the theater owner was making money when the place would normally be closed anyway. A win-win. The PR campaign was key in these shows. They would either have a trailer made that the theater would show before every film and during every intermission. These were usually better than the show itself. A radio ad would also precede the engagement by at least a week or two, getting folks pumped up. The night of the show, guests were treated to some horror magic. Some monsters in suits running into the audience, whispering things and touching you. And a lights out segment where phosphorescent paint on skeletons or ghostly shapes were flown over the audience by men in the balconies via a fishing pole. Most of these producers were out-of-work magicians, and some, like Phil Morris, were incredibly talented and polished, creating spectacular shows. After all this, the movie would start. By now it's at least 1 a.m., so if people left the theater after the live act, that was okay. The performers could relax. Some would continue to go through the audience to scare patrons or dress up like the monsters on screen and punch up the value factor. These sound incredible, right? I want to go to a midnight spooker too. But when a lot of other people, we'll call them hacks, started seeing lines around the block for some of these great shows and words started spreading of how good they were, the supply outweighed the demand. So these individuals would get a movie, do a half-assed job with the live pre-show, act unprofessionally, and generally put on a crappy imitation of a good midnight spooker. They had people's money already, and they were only in town for the weekend. Then on to the next town to shyster them too. When a good show would come to town, the attendance would be lower because they had been to a crappy one before. Sound familiar? There were only so many good shows out there, and people wanted to be scared by more than a movie all over the country, especially in rural towns that were not close enough to a big city. This was their only chance to see this kind of live entertainment. Well, you know what happens when you water the soup. That's right, people stopped buying it, and the midnight spookers died out. But people still wanted to be scared, so horror movies got a huge boost in the 60s. As more and more looked for that thrill, that challenge. People wanted new monsters, too. Sure, the old standbys were still cool, but now they wanted more obscure creatures, demons, mutants, and with the Night of the Living Dead in 1968, zombies. Some were good quality, and some were cheap flicks out to make a buck, but folks went to see them anyway. Seems to be a recurring theme here. During the 60s, dark rides, pretzel rides, and the like were becoming more popular in theme parks around the country. Attraction owners took notice. Walt Disney had been working on his Haunted Mansion idea, part walk-through attraction, part ride, for years, but he never got a cohesive design together as other projects kept pushing it back. Then he passed away in 1966, the year I was born, actually. His Imagineers wanted to see this last project of Walt's come to life and worked for the next 3 years finalizing plans, inventing new animations, illusions, concepts, artwork, and all the things that go into a first-class attraction. The Haunted Mansion at Disneyland in California opened in 1969, and it was amazing. It still is. Night of the Living Dead was released the year before, and with that gritty newfound popularity of zombies, some were not sure how the mansion would be received. Guests were blown away. It became one of the most successful attractions in the park, and still is today. Now guests wanted to get the chance to see more attractions like the Haunted Mansion, and producers took notice. Other attractions around the country were now realizing people wanted this walk-through kind of haunted house, and started to emulate it to the best of their ability. Of course, there's only one Disney, but Knott's Berry Farm, also in California, had a huge theme park as well, and in 1973, they ran their first haunted show in the park called Knott's Scary Farm. They converted areas to be spooky, made, I believe, 3 haunted houses, and it was a big success. Now it's the 1970s. Around this time, small charity organizations looking for fundraisers figured out around Halloween time, they could put on a small scary experience, charge a donation, and make some money. volunteers were utilized, condemned houses were used or locations were donated, and materials would either be sponsored or supplied by people putting on these haunted shows, this became quite popular, and soon, organizations were trying to outdo each other with their displays or shows. Remember, there was no internet, no Facebook with 1,000 posts about 12-foot skeletons. You had to find inspiration on your own, then figure out how to make the scary. Like in the past with the classic Universal monsters, most took their inspiration from the movies. The 70s was a no-holds-barred creative frenzy of horror, with everything from masochistic killers like Last House on the Left, I still can't watch that movie, to The Exorcist in 1973, Texas Chainsaw Massacre in 74, Jaws in 75, The Omen and Carrie in 76, Dawn of the Dead and John Carpenter's Halloween, both released in 1978, and Alien in 1979. Most of these franchises you know and are still going strong almost 50 years on. Imagine the impact they had when they were just released. This was the start of haunted houses as we know them. The JCs, standing for Junior Commerce, was a charitable organization started in St. Louis, Missouri, focusing on community service and leadership training utilizing local volunteers. The JCs were one of the largest purveyors of charity haunted houses in the country at that time. I'm from New Jersey originally, and in the 70s it was known as the Haunted House State, largely due to the JCs. They were wildly successful making money with these pop-up attractions, usually utilizing abandoned or condemned buildings and houses. These volunteers would go in, paint areas black, or fluorescent scenes would be painted, depending on what the actors wanted in their rooms or scenes. Often, people made up their own characters and skits. Some were better than others, but hey, it's for charity, and everyone had a good time. But they had little or no overhead, no insurance, volunteer workforce, donated supplies in many cases, and creative people wanting to make something special. There was a small budget for expenses, but the bottom line is they made money. This did not go unnoticed, and soon others wanted to do the same thing, but for profit. This was, of course, a different animal, as they soon discovered. Without free spaces to use, renting space was expensive, supplies cost money, talent cost money and time. Many would skirt insurance if possible, trying to get in and get out before the given town even knew they were there. Many tried to go the cheap route, doing anything they could to get this thing open with the bare minimum. This is where some of the negative reputation of haunted houses originated. Just like the Midnight Spookers back in the day, some of these shows were great, while others, just out to make a buck, were watering down the soup. Thing is, if you go to a haunted house and start counting heads, then multiply that by the entrance fee, you might think these guys are making a killing. And back then, that was more of a possibility. But there are more expenses than you could ever guess until you put on a show like this yourself. Now, more than ever. So it's the 80s. New wave music, video makes more low-budget movie making possible. And with video rental stores, people can actually see your film. That's amazing. Horror movie sections were and still are one of the most frequently watched media. Of course, cheap, bloody, gory movies inspire the same in individual haunted attractions. I started teaching myself special effects makeup around this time with books. No internet or videos to help. Trial and error were good teachers, along with Richard Corson's stage makeup book, which I had to order from a bookstore and pay $70-some-odd for. I did makeup effects for one of those Blood on the Highway videos with the state police. That was pretty cool. And at that time, I didn't even know you could work at a haunted house. Then in 1984, the Six Flags Great Adventure, New Jersey, haunted house fire occurred, killing 8 people. And that changed our industry forever. Up until that point, most attractions, since they were temporary, were flying under the radar of state and town officials. Until then, you could come in, set up an attraction quickly, make your money during October, and then pack it up and be out in a week. Those days are gone.
Never fun losing.
This was the start of regulation and development of the Special Amusement Building Code we are now all too familiar with, which is fine, I'm all about safety. Let me say, I am from New Jersey, and I was actually in the park just 2 days before the fire happened, and of course, I went through the haunted house. It was unsafe. It was exceedingly dark, made up of 14 tractor trailers end to end in a maze pattern. Very disorienting, some dead ends, extremely narrow areas to get through, no smoke detectors and no sprinklers. I know exactly how that fire happened, and as an 18-year-old kid, who knows, maybe I could have done the same thing that that person did. In one area, pitch black, you walked around, felt around actually, a fenced-in area, and walked straight into a wall, which was padded with foam so you didn't hurt yourself. When you got there, an actor turned on a strobe light to your left, and a chainsaw, real, no electric ones back then, came on as an actor came at you. Then the strobe light cut out, and as you cough fumes, you had to feel your way past there and find the exit down another hallway. The emergency exit doors were chained shut so people couldn't get in that way. Here's the thing, it was pitch black. If I had a lighter back then, maybe I would have taken it out to see where I was going. This is what happened when another kid lit their lighter to see and walked right into that foam. Whoosh. The place was ablaze in seconds. This tragedy brought haunted houses into the light, so to speak, and made us all accountable. Pro-haunted houses should be accountable. You should feel safe, have fun, and not worry how something is built or if something is going to harm you. We're entertainers. Haunted houses are an entertainment. Fun. Hopefully a fun business that makes money too. After the following industry shakeup, a lot of haunted houses were closed. Some came back stronger than ever, and some new ones came into the business, but choices were few in most places if you wanted to go to a haunted house in the late 80s. Now it's 1990. People were looking for more interactive experiences like haunted houses. There are still a lot of charity haunts like the JC's and sole proprietors, and of course Disney and Knott's. But if you wanted to go to a big Halloween event, there really weren't any around. Salem, Mass., the Witch City, was a big October and Halloween destination, and there were some haunted attractions there along with the Witch Museum, of course. But like most locations in a historical town, they were rather small. I started working my first professional haunted house, the Haunted Castle, in Hamburg, New Jersey, after seeing its first year in operation in 1990, working with my soon-to-be friend Rich Hanf. I was in charge of makeup and helping with build-out, then running part of the castle, and of course being a monster. During the same time, Universal Studios Florida was creating what would become Hollywood Horror Nights, opening in 91 with one haunted house, the Dungeon of Terror, and for only four nights. Meanwhile, in Berlin, Massachusetts, some entrepreneurs were developing the first horror theme park, Spooky World. There were small Halloween events around, apple picking, some lone haunted houses, and pumpkin picking hay rides on farms, but not much haunted stuff. Spooky World wanted to create a place where families could go and experience that New England fall and Halloween atmosphere. So in 1991, they opened with a haunted hayride, the Halloween retail store and autograph barn, and the chance to meet Tom Savini, special effects master of Night of the Living Dead, and Kane Hodder, who played Jason in Friday the 13th. Spooky World would run all 31 days of October and expected to have 500 people opening night, but ended up with 5,000. It was a runaway hit and instantly became a New England Halloween tradition. The next year, they would add the Tom Savini animatronic haunted house, and the third year, the American Horror Museum with actual movie props for guests to see. This started a heyday for haunted houses in the 90s across the nation. Spooky would be the haunted theme park that other haunts in the country wanted to grow up to be. Many people were getting on the bandwagon and trying to open an attraction. Remember, at this time, there was no internet like it is today. That was just getting started, and no Facebook or other media services like that. What we did have, however, were chat rooms on different servers called BBSs, which in the beginning were very basic. There were some live chats, but you couldn't go back and look at stuff like on Facebook. It was live. But there were threads where someone could post a comment and others that knew the answer, hopefully, would respond. The most impressive of these was the Halloween L list. Many would-be haunters in the country learned and shared information for the first time here. Knowledge had to be researched, but where to do that? Where do you start? Meanwhile, in Chicago, there was a giant trade show called Transworld that featured costumes, props, and other Halloween and party items. This is where stores would go to purchase all the Halloween items that you would later find in the stores come October. And it was actually three shows in one, with party supplies, costuming, and Halloween elements. But it wasn't open to the public. You had to have a store to attend. Due to the growing demand for Halloween items in particular, in 1995, Halloween got its own trade show. Everything from makeup, costumes, props, novelties, animatronics, masks, and in 96, for the first time, Haunt Education could be found here. Transworld Halloween Trade Show was off and running. This is when Rich Hanf and I were brought into Spooky World to design a brand new hayride and two new additional haunted houses, bringing that number up to three. For several years, there were no major improvements in the park, yet advertising spouted all new. Spooky had to grow or die, so we were hired. We created the first all-clown haunted house in the country, the Cirque Macabre, a European circus of fear, and the Phantom Mineshaft haunted house. The hayride, which used to portray vignettes on the trail, where the wagon would stop at sometimes goofy skits, usually where a victim was killed with the help of a blood pump spraying colored water as the wagon pulled away, always ending with the Texas chainsaw. The new trail would be ambitious. The wagon would only stop at the first scene, and that's for 2 minutes, then continue all the way through to the end. It was a time travel or time sliding theme where the wagon drove through portals which transported the guests to alternate universes of horror. There was the Dr. Wells lab where you were sent through time, then a Mad Max apocalyptic future, Planet of the Apes, a 1950s town with all manner of monsters and a UFO, then Cretaceous Park, a Victorian graveyard, the Wild West world, and ending in a toxic dump area with four chainsaws. In later years, Spooky would grow and move locations to include a giant theatrical hayride, six huge super detailed haunted houses, three museums, carnival rides, food trucks, a host of world-class actors and walk-around performers, state-of-the-art makeup, professionally handmade costumes, and of course, retail store. Many of these elements would be firsts in the industry. Back to Spooky 96. We got it all finished and with wet paint opened October 1st, 1996 to rave reviews. Spooky World was back. That year, Rich and I were prominent speakers at the first Transworld Haunt Education Seminars in Chicago. It was standing room only. Haunters and prospective haunters were starving for information and we just gave it to them. Well, for money, but we gave it to them. Salem, Massachusetts, the Witch City, also had a boom with haunted attractions, and there was a lot to see there. Not to mention, Halloween itself was the most incredible costume spectacle in the country. I have worked on almost every attraction in that town at one time or another. Now, there were places following the haunted theme park blueprint, and multi-venue attractions were springing up all over, as well as individual haunts. Hooray! Just like with the Midnight Spookers, however, see, everything comes full circle. Some people went counting heads and tried to cash in on the haunted house craze to make a buck. Some put out a good product and some did not. The bad ones tended to water down the soup for the good ones. But luckily, the internet was coming around, and suddenly, there were places to find new haunts and get some feedback on whether an attraction was the basic type or a more professional version. Make no mistake, you didn't need a huge budget to make an amazing guest experience. You needed to love it, however, and you could usually tell which was which when you went through. I've seen some amazing scares, scenes, and performances in tiny haunts with no budget. They had a good idea and made it manifest. You can guess where it goes from there. Some haunts grew, some faded away, more came into the industry to try their hand at haunting. Regulations became more defined and strict, such as when haunted attractions were specified into the special amusement section of the building codes in 1999. The new millennium was 20 years ago already. Wow, that was fast. The haunted heyday may have leveled out due to rising costs, insurance, safety guidelines, and better building materials required, but all of that was inevitable from the beginning. And that's good. Audiences, however, got used to special effects in movies and wanted to walk through those scenes in real time, then have them reset seconds later for the next group in a haunt. This was difficult, to say the least. Finally, however, technology started to catch up to expectations if used wisely and creatively. You have always been able to do this, but now it's becoming affordable and could be done in half the time. Better special effects and illusions were the result, with even smaller haunts stunning guests with some of their scenes. Now you look around, and in Home Depot you have effects for $299 that would have cost thousands years ago. I can't wait to see what comes next in haunting. Some say everything has been done before, and in most cases this is true, but the big challenge that makes it new is how it is executed and presented. I predict more polished shows to develop as we go forward, after we are all allowed to go forward, that is, and cooler, more affordable illusions. This should bring some amazing effects into the guest experience, but just like back in 1903, nothing will take the place of that thrill, that perceived danger that can only be truly enjoyed if the guest knows they are actually safe. Safety is and has been the key to the success of haunting from the beginning, and it will always be so. Be safe, my friends, and haunt on. Oh, look at the time. Well, we'll wrap up this segment. In future episodes, we'll talk about more aspects of professional haunting, their methods, philosophies, how-tos, and so much more. But I see our moments here are up, so until the next time, be safe. This is Wick Ed Gannon, www.somethingwickedproductions.com, saying, have a wicked day.
I'm gone now. Heaven help you.
Please like and follow the podcast. Stalk us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Links in the description. And help us by sharing HauntCast with all your haunt and Halloween brethren. Until next time. Stay scary.